Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Boris Effects. I'm Steve Hallfish, ACE. I'm a working film, TV, and documentary editor. Over the last 10 years, I've done more than 400 interviews with the world's best editors. Welcome to episode 16 of season 10. I've been using Boris Effects products for 30 years, and I'm proud to partner with them to bring you some great filmmaking content. Today on Art of the Cut, we're talking with one of the editors of the Netflix miniseries Griselda. Kelly Stuyvesant joins us for this conversation. The other editors on the series are Joaquin Elizondo and Christopher Cavanaugh. Kelly's credits include work on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Hellstrom, and The Sandman. Before I hop into our discussion with Kelly, a brief thank you to our partner, Boris Effects. I've been using Boris Effects and Sapphire for 30 years, so they're not just a sponsor to me. I feel like they've been a partner in my cutting room for decades, helping me to deliver on the creative vision of my clients, directors, and producers. For all of us, our work is about bringing a creative idea to the screen, and for me, Boris Effects is one of the important tools that I use to do that. To see how they can help you on your latest project, head on over to borisfx.com and check out the Boris Effects suite, which includes Sapphire, Continuum, Mocha Pro, Silhouette, and Optics, all in a low-cost monthly or annual subscription. If you want to read this interview with great visual support, you can go to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC. That site also has other great filmmaking content, so keep that bookmarked. And now, Kelly Stuyvesant discusses editing Netflix's Griselda. Kelly, it is so nice to have you on the show. I've been watching Griselda and loving it. Character development seems huge, right?
Character development was the big overarching thing. We had one director for all six episodes, Andy Baez. The Griselda story was always at the heart of everything, and all our conversations circled around that and the journey she goes on, and the North Star guiding light was, you know, how did everything revolve around Griselda and her point of view and how this impacted her and shaped her. And for me, it was my favorite kind of thing to cut. I love stuff that has a lot of subtext and character and nuance, and every little choice kind of adds up to a larger picture.
You mentioned point of view, and that's always an interesting idea for an editor. You've got all this coverage, but the coverage can be focused into a point of view, right? And is that something you felt like you needed to do?
You know, there's a mission statement going into it and how it was shot and how they wanted to stage the scenes. And, you know, Andy would make some really interesting choices and blocking, and, you know, how Sophia might be the focal point. But then Andy also really believed in the power of editorials. So he likes to cover everything. He likes to cover his bases. He, you know, he might have a game plan and an idea, but he's going to shoot so that there's lots of options in the editing room, and he likes us to kind of do our thing. He doesn't want to box us into anything too soon or too quickly. But, you know, that was one of the really interesting things with keeping things from Griselda's point of view is, you know, we're also still telling a story of someone who has done some very bad things. And so there's a lot of gray area there in that we're unpacking how someone could make the choices they make and the nuances behind that, but we're not validating what she's doing. And I think there's a lot of engaging with the audience in terms of like, oh, you were rooting for her, but now look at what she's done. And I think, you know, playing it from her point of view doesn't necessarily mean that you are approving of everything she does. And so there's a lot of really fun choices we can make in the music or, you know, in the juxtaposition of things that, you know, we're inside her head, we're approaching things from her angle, but we're also making a commentary at the same time. And we're making choices to kind of make you question why you might be rooting for her in this moment, or when she gets her comeuppance, you know, you want to be careful how you handle things like that, because her getting her comeuppance isn't a pity party. I think there's a lot of room to be playful and have fun a little bit. So, you know, when she's down on her luck or when she's doing something wrong, you can be a little tongue in cheek because you're not treating her like this mythic martyr, this great person that does all these things. It is a really interesting world to live in and navigate. Any scene, big or small, we're always kind of thinking, okay, how are we feeling about her as an audience? How is she feeling about herself? How are the other characters feeling about her? You know, what do we want to come away with? What's the right tone to hit? And I think there's a lot of responsibility in that too, because, you know, you don't really want to glorify this world that she's living in.
I've talked to somebody that said also on the flip side of that kind of is you can't judge your characters. Morally, you can't judge your characters because it would affect you, I would think.
Yeah, that's a really interesting take. You know, I've heard that a lot from especially actors' points of views and things like that. And I think there's a lot of fluidity with it. You don't want to judge them and make choices that are confining you or choices that are discouraging a conversation. My favorite things to watch and engage in and participate are where people can have conversations afterwards or debates, or they can walk away with a different point of view than someone that was sitting right next to them and watching it. And so in that sense, I think, yeah, you don't want to be heavy-handed with your judgment. You don't want to limit what someone can take away from something. I do think, though, there is a certain responsibility in terms of understanding what you're engaging in and what the material is and what reactions you are looking to elicit. What we choose to shine a light on, what we choose to give people pleasure in partaking in, that does affect the cultural discourse as a whole. It affects our values, and you want to make something that sits in a space you're comfortable with, if that makes sense.
You mentioned a few minutes ago the mission statement. What was that? What kind of discussions did you have with the director or the showrunner to say, this is the direction we're trying to head before we start cutting?
One of the big things hanging over everyone was the Narcos background and the Narcos history in those shows. I came to the table on Griselda as a newbie. A lot of the team, both in production, post-production, had worked on other Narcos shows before. And I came as a fan of Narcos, and I really liked what they did with those shows. And there was a big conversation about how Griselda came from very similar DNA, similar sensibilities and storytelling, but it needed its own identity. It wasn't living in the exact same world or universe. We were using actors as new characters. It was its own story, but you also aren't trying to deny your roots or deny where it came from. So that was a big part of the conversation early on, is what's inherent to the DNA of those who are wishing to tell this story and what is different. You know, I think Griselda is a little lighter, a little funner, a little more tongue-in-cheek at times. You know, it's a mini series. It has a very closed arc. So there's a lot of conversations in terms of style, in terms of tone. And what was really exciting was that the door was also wide open on that. There's a lot of room to find our voice as we went. And one of the things that Andy did that I loved, our director, is he was constantly sending us Spotify playlists of music from everywhere. Just things he was listening to while he was working on scenes, things that he liked, tones, stuff from the 80s, stuff from Miami, stuff from Columbia. He had lots of classical music. It was a way to get into the headspace, and it helped me very early on kind of lock into his sensibilities, and that he was really interested in being playful and discovering things and trying things and trying the unexpected. And so, you know, we had music we could pull from to use in our cut, even if it was temp or if they were songs that we wanted to stay in. But it also gave me a sensibility of his liking. So then I could go off and look for music myself that I thought might work well in the cut. And then it was a lot of micro conversations. You know, there wasn't one big, here's the blueprint team, here's the game plan. Andy likes to keep in touch throughout the shoot. It was a long shoot. All six episodes were block shot. So there'd be a lot of daily conversations just about little moments, little scenes. How's this playing? What reaction is this eliciting from you in the dailies? What do you think of this? Every single one was like a glimpse into the headspace. One of the things that was a real pleasure on the show was just kind of how unified everyone was. It wasn't one of those situations where there was a lot of cooks in the kitchen or differing points of view. Andy was kind of one of our point people at the head, is directing all of them. Eric Newman was very involved. Andy, of course, would have conversations with everyone, with our writers, with our directors, with the cinematographer, and helped coalesce all that into one idea, one point of view. It really felt like a unified team all the way through, which was great and a real pleasure to be a part of.
You mentioned block shooting. How was the block shoot? And how was the editing done? Did you checkerboard 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6? Or
so the way it worked is Joaquin did the odd episodes, episode 1, episode 3, and episode 5. And I did the even episodes 2, 4, and 6. And the entire scene was shot across the board as if it was one long 6-hour movie. We tended to front load the earlier episodes and the later episodes were on the back end, but it was willy-nilly. And I think we had the benefit of having scripts ready to go from the beginning. So it was shot all in LA, but location availability, maximizing it. There was no traditional schedule that I've experienced on network TV or other episodic TV where you're in dailies for one episode and maybe in a producer's cut for another. It was kind of dailies all the time for months, sending cuts to Andy when we felt good about stuff, sharing things. And then he would be giving us notes. Well, at the same time, we were still getting in more dailies. So then we were kind of juggling the mental bandwidth of like, all right, I've got a couple rounds of notes on these scenes from Andy that I want to do while they're fresh in my head. But I've also got, 5 hours of daily that just came in today and new scenes will inform the pacing and the timing. And then so it was this kind of evolving fluid editor's director's cut all the way through shooting. I think we shot from... I could be mistaken, but I think we shot from around January to July, so for about 7 months. And then once we wrapped shooting, Andy came in and then we refined each cut for each episode. And then after that, things kind of followed a more traditional structure of going from directors to producers to Netflix and so on.
You mentioned kind of juggling the schedule while you were in dailies. Talk about some of the decisions that you would make about like just what you wanted to do that day. Like, oh, as you said, I want to do notes now while they're fresh, or I don't want to think about notes. I just need a new fresh scene.
It's a very individual thing. And one of the things I really appreciated is that we had some freedom and flexibility to structure our day in the way that we work best. So for me, I have a pretty good sensibility of how I work and where my time is best spent. Is this a day where, I just need to put blinders on and really dig into this giant meaty scene? Do I need to tackle some low-hanging fruit and knock some stuff off my plate? Knowing the priorities in terms of set was helpful. Knowing if there was a scene that was going to inform how another scene was shot would obviously shape the priority. For me, I tend to really dig in on my first cuts. So, I know a lot of editors, sometimes they work best where they cut very quickly and very intuitively and slap something together, and then it's a constant course of refinement. I tend to be pretty thorough from the get-go, and I take a lot of time, and I really analyze. I look at all the dailies. I look at all the performances. I'll live with a couple different performances while the scene is taking shape, trying to decide what direction I want it to go. It takes some time for me to put together my first cut of a scene. And then it really doesn't change that much after that. Micro tweaks here and there, but it's pretty solid from the beginning. So then by the time I would share something, even though we were sharing stuff early before we had full cuts of scenes, when I was sending stuff to Andy, it was already in a pretty solid place. It already had its shape, its structure. And then it made the notes part of the process pretty easy and fluid, so that if Andy had thoughts on X, Y, or Z, I had a good foundation to go on. And I think that was really helpful for the success of that workflow, with kind of knowing how your director likes to work and knowing when is the right time for them to weigh in on a scene. And I was really grateful to kind of have that freedom to find the schedule that maximized how we all work best.
Were you under any time constraints on episode length?
No, we weren't. Though, with anything, you want it to feel right with pacing, and, you don't want to overstay your welcome. The goal is always to be, have a good runtime, have a good pace, have a good feel. No one was very precious. There were a lot of things that ended up on the cutting room floor, a lot of things that didn't make it in, not because we had any hard time that we had to hit, but just because we were looking for the best way to tell the story.
Talk to me about some of those decisions. If it can be any length, and let's say the performances are always great, you're not dropping a scene because, it's not a good scene. What's motivating that? What are the discussions around cutting something?
I think a lot of that comes down to what you know and what you're waiting to know. People will get impatient if they're too far ahead of the story. So if you're building towards something and it's clear where you're headed, people are going to get bored if they're waiting for you to catch up to them. But vice versa, if you're just bulldozing full speed ahead and you can't wait to get to your destination and you're leaving people behind you, then that's where you get confusion. And if you don't take the time to develop a character or let people get emotionally invested, then there's no hope for a payoff. So, you know, those were the conversations always running in our mind. Actually finding the sweet spot, easier said than done. I think one of the perks of having multiple episodes in the air at the same time is you get a chance to look at something with fresh eyes by virtue of setting one episode aside for a little bit and spending time on another one. And then you can circle back with a little bit of distance and kind of think, okay, did we achieve what we set out to achieve in our last round of notes? And there was a lot of restructuring, reordering that would happen, moving scenes around, but it was always in service of the bigger picture, the arc, the story, when we give people information, and then we would have an opportunity to sit with it for a little bit because we weren't rushed for time, because we weren't racing towards this hard deadline. And then we could circle back to it and think about it and assess how well we were striking that balance at the time. We were work from home for all of production and shooting. And then once that was done, we switched to a hybrid workflow where sometimes I would be working from home. Sometimes I would be in an office setting. And when we were in an office, then there was an opportunity. If it was my episode, we might grab Joaquin and the three of us would sit in and watch, and just having someone else in the room is always helpful, and vice versa. I would sit in on theirs, or Andy would just be ping pong in between the two rooms and give us stuff to work on. It's always a tricky thing, finding that right balance. And I always circle back to just, what do we know? What do we want people to know? You know, where are we at this point in time?
Did you deliver all six episodes at the same time?
No, it was a tiered delivery structure. It was much more how you would imagine it traditionally, where we would get notes on one and work on it. And when they signed off, we would lock it. And then we would keep working on the others. And episodes five and six were the last. You're starting to think about the six episodes as a whole. So it just kind of made sense to start chronologically knocking them off, because you might make some lifts in one that would have ripple effects and ramifications in another.
I just talked to another set of TV series editors, and they were talking about, like, looking back at episode one that still hadn't been delivered, deciding whether, you know, oh, well, now that we know what episode five looks like, should we go back and change episode one?
Yeah, it's a dangerous game.
Yeah, true.
I love having the time to be creative, and I love not working under a deadline. You know, I think the flip side of that is if you have all the time in the world, you can just pick something apart to death. You're never going to run out of things to try, ever. I mean, there's always something you didn't try that you could try.
Did you watch the other episodes, or did you just read the scripts and that's all you needed?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Partly just as a fan that wants to watch. As co-workers, I think it's great to be able to talk about each other's episodes. That's one of the things I like about cutting television. I love having another editor that you can just talk shop with. Having someone that completely understands where you're coming from, whether it's a hype or a gripe, you have that companionship, but also to inform the story and the cut. And because this was something that didn't have a template ahead of time, someone might unlock some way to handle something, some tonal thing in one episode, and you want to carry that through line in yours. So I think Joaquin was keeping up to date on my episodes, and I definitely was keeping up to date on his, because it was fun to see how they evolved. It informed how I cut things. It informed the choices I made. It made sure I was in the loop on what was going on. Anything I work on, I think I'm a bit snoopy by nature. I like to see what's going on with the other episodes, but I also think it's a great way to come up with a cohesive whole for a series.
Well, you mentioned at the very top of the interview how important the character arc was. So if you're missing a half of the character arc, that's kind of hard place to be.
I might have a scene in my episode that carries a lot of emotional resonance because of a scene in another episode. And so you really want to make sure that you're balancing it all appropriately.
When you get dailies in, what do you tell your assistant to do? And then what do? You walk in and there's a new bin.
So my assistant on this episode was Charlie Viramontes, the first time working together, and he was great, had an amazing attitude. And well, I was about to say, I'm pretty easy to prep for, but really you should ask Charlie, because I think we all think we're easy. We find out that we're a nightmare. I don't want anything too fancy with my daily prep. So Charlie will prep the dailies for the day and group any multicams that need to be grouped and organize the bin and kind of just a loose following the script order. And then I tend to, as I work, I reorganize my bin in a way spatially. It's almost like a tactile urge for me as I'm editing. Like I just start mentally kind of moving and grouping things in a way that only makes sense to me and I could never translate to anyone else. And then the way I like to work is at the bottom of the bin, I have one sequence that we still call a chem roll, even though it's a little outdated, that just has all the media barfed onto one long timeline so that if I ever need to just scroll through and be like, I'm looking for this one angle, this one thing, I can kind of just breeze through everything, which usually isn't helpful until I would say more in the notes phase when we're starting to like really dig and look for little pieces. But it also gives me a sense of how many hours I have, because I think in terms of hours, not page count for a scene. And then when it's time for me to cut a scene, I like to watch everything. I tend to work my way backwards. So for example, if there's five or six takes of a setup, I usually start with take six and work my way back, because I like to see where they ended up and then watch where they started with. Part of the reason I do that is I think there's nothing like the very first time you watch a take or setup. It's when you're your freshest and most honest impressions. If they did 10 takes of something, there was a reason. And so I like to start there. And then it's a really interesting thing to see the backwards progression of where they started with. And one thing I found is that if they're doing a lot of takes, they're really trying to get to the heart of something. But other things can kind of fall by the wayside in the process. So you might get some more honest line reading, some more present performances early on. And then if everyone's very narrowly focused on achieving this one goal, you might need to balance that out. That's one reason why I like to work backwards. And I just happen to work on things with a lot of directors that shoot a lot and do a lot of takes. So that's how I keep myself fresh. And I do something that is very similar to, it's kind of a combination line cut select pass, where as I watch everything, I'm putting in a timeline everything I like, which is almost everything. I try not to be too picky from the start. It's very rare that I won't put a line reading in or something unless I just know there's a reason. If I'm just certain, I'm not going to use it. But I try to be very open-minded. So it's very similar to a line cut, but I also am grouping things and making little mini edits really quick of like, oh, what does this look like if it's juxtaposed against this? And so I'll end up with a sequence that it could be an hour long if it's a lot of dailies. And it's just kind of this like massive work reel. And then when I go to start cutting the scene, I go off that sequence and I load it into my preview. And then I start going through and looking at performances. And at that point, sometimes I'll leave little notes to myself as I'm going through the dailies, like, oh, this might be a great reaction for this moment, or little breadcrumbs to remember. So as I'm watching all the dailies and throwing down my selects, it's kind of percolating in the back of my head how I want the scene to start. It's really helpful with big scenes for me doing that process, because sometimes I'll be halfway through cutting a scene and suddenly I'll have to jump into another episode. And then a few hours later, I'll have to jump back in and pick up where I left off. And it, you know, mentally, it's very hard to shift your headspace around. And sometimes you feel like you have to start at the very beginning. So for me, that process really helps me find a way to dive back into where I was beforehand and not lose track of everything and not lose track of what was shot. And especially when you're working with coverage that it might start on one person, but then it picks up another person and then it racks focus to another. So I don't want to lose track of all the moments that are tagged and all the things, which is why my first cuts take a lot of time. I do a very kind of ground up, very thorough approach. And then by the time I have a first pass, I feel like I really know the footage really well. I really know our options. And then from there, I tend to have a pretty easy time retooling the scene, addressing any notes that are possible. You know, if someone doesn't like a line read, I've already got access to kind of a super cut of all the line reads that I thought worked really well for the scene.
What are some things that when you were going through this particular show that you found were either challenging or really rewarding? Or was there something you just loved cutting?
One thing I'm proud about that always gives me joy every time I watch it is in episode 4 of Griselda. It's a real turning point episode for her, and it's kind of her Breaking Bad moment. At the very end, towards the scene, she has her lover / bodyguard is telling her, go out while you're on top. And it's her acknowledgement that she's in it for more than her family and the money. You know, she has a chance to ride off into the sunset, but she wants the victory. There's this great moment where she burns all this cocaine that she's been robbing from everyone else. She gives this really great speech to the Marilitos and her crew. It's her coming into her own for the second half. And there's this music cue that I just love. It felt at the time like a big risk putting it in because, you know, you're in your bubble. You think, I love this, but is everyone else going to be like, what the hell are you thinking doing this? I got some really great advice from an editor that I worked with for a long time, Dave Crabtree, that kind of mentored me. And one of the things he said was, don't go for the safe cut. Don't go for the safe moment. Don't go for the thing that you know plays because you're going to end up with something that's average. But if you give it a shot and throw something at the wall and see if it sticks, the worst thing is people say they don't like it and you go to the safe cut. But, you know, you want to push the edges. That's part of your job. You're the one that sees everything. So for the scene where she burns it, you know, I had all this music from Andy. I'd been pulling my own music. And there's this great cue. It's called Lullaby and Ragtime by Harry Nilsson. And it's not at all the song that you would initially, I think to put in this scene. And there's just something about it where I was like, let's give it a try. And as soon as I laid it in, I just loved it. And before that, I'd been looking for like badass boss anthems or like Season of the Witch or like something that just felt like we were riding on top with her. The way it juxtaposed it was so great because it's this beautiful, mellow melody, but it doesn't take away any of the energy or the momentum. And it goes from there into a couple other scenes. It was just so fun. And I loved it instantly. When it first hits Thunder Griselda, you just get this sense of finality and the decision she's made. And there's something kind of like epic and poetic about it. And it kind of makes you feel like, yeah, she's like a Scarface villain. It's not celebrating her like, yeah, look at this badass woman. It's just kind of like, well, she made that choice. And you know, she's proud in her victory, but it's also the beginning of her downfall. And I feel like the song kind of alludes to that a little bit. And then you see Dario, her lover, that's been trying to talk her down. And he's realizing the decision she's just made. There's some sadness in that. And then we take the song, carry the song, and we go to one of her sicarios assassinating someone on her behalf. It's suggested violence, but you've still got this beautiful lullaby playing. You cut to the scene of Griselda kind of savoring her victory as the news report comes on, and there's like mischievousness. And I think what I loved about it is it let us live in Griselda celebrating her success, but it also somehow juxtaposed that with this melancholy of what that decision really means and kind of alluding to it. And I worked for a showrunner that used to always say with our songs, you know, we don't want to play the house number. We don't want this song where the lyrics are telling you what you already know. And so I just loved how it fit weirdly in a way you couldn't really articulate, but I had no idea if anyone else was going to like it. Every time the cut got in front of someone, they're just like, man, I love that sound cue. I love that music. And it was just this little high every time. I guess it worked because, you know, I was so ready to just be like, yeah, I tried something silly, guys. It's all right. Let's move on. It was one of those great moments where you couldn't really articulate all the reasons why it worked. You just hoped that people were in sync with what you were thinking. And it clicked for so many people in the same way. And so then you just have that shared, like, yeah, it works, right?
You mentioned that don't go for the safe cut editor. I couldn't quite understand who that was. Who did you say?
That was Dave Crabtree. He was an editor on Psych for USA. And I worked for him for a long time on a couple different shows. And he also is a talented director in his own right. So it was a great position to be in as an assistant editor, because when he would go direct something, I would get to move up and cut. And it was a great chance to kind of have an opportunity to audition for people and show them what I could do. And that's how I ultimately did end up making the jump full-time to editor, was for people that I had cut for when I was filling in for him. I still will, I'll be cutting scenes, and sometimes I'm like, what would Dave do here?
What would Dave do indeed? I love the idea of this piece of music that you dropped in, knowing, I don't know if anybody's going to buy this, because I tell you, my ego sometimes will, I fight those because I'm like, I'm going to put this in and people are going to think I'm an idiot. I can't do it.
Yeah.
But that you just have to.
That's when you're closest to greatness. When it's like you're either going to fail spectacularly or they're going to love it.
That is a great quote. I will remember that. The next time I'm going to put in a stupid music cue that I think is great, but no one will believe, I'm going to go, I'm so close to greatness here. I just have to pull the trigger.
Yes, As someone who could never in my life do stand-up comedy, I feel a kindred spirit for this idea that you have to be comfortable with bombing in order to like do something good. And I will say too, I think it's also a testament to working in an environment that's a really safe space. If you don't have job security, you can't take those creative risks. But you know, this is definitely encouraged from day one to play and to find the voice and to do things, and so you can take those leaps of faith, and you know that at the worst they'll be like, nah, we're not feeling you on this, and then you can just secretly be like, well, I like it, then just get rid of it.
Yeah, that does make a difference, right? The safe space part of it.
Absolutely. I think it's our job as editors to encourage anyone that's in the room with us to feel like it's a safe space, and you hope to get that back. I think people have a lot of respect in a creative field for someone if they know they're not holding back in what they give them. You know, I think that that's something we can offer as an editor, is that when you give them a cut, like they know you didn't hold back and that you gave them what you thought was the most exciting dynamic version of their material. And then the second part of your job is to then help them hone it in to the vision they had in mind. But, you know, I don't think anyone wants to feel like, you know, oh, great, I have to dig through all this material because I don't know if they really went for it.
And that's true for our assistants too, right? You've got to let your assistant know, give me some stupid idea or tell me you hate an edit, right? They've got to feel safe or else you don't get good feedback.
Absolutely. The last thing I want is someone that wants to flatter my ego or say yes. It's a really wonderful thing when you can have a really honest relationship with your assistant, because it's also a safety net. Like, for all my bravado about take the risk, do the things, like, it's nice to have someone in your corner that you can, like, am I insane right now? Especially when you're trying to convince yourself that a cut works, because it would make your life so much easier if it worked.
How do you promote your assistants? How do you get them to move up in the world of editing?
I love working with assistants that want to cut and have a passion and want to be editors. And I've benefited so much from people mentoring me. And I threw out Dave Crabtree, but I'm very lucky. Every editor I worked with really took the time to teach me, to give me opportunities, to let me cut. So it's definitely something I want to pass on to them. And I think it's a part of the job of being an editor that I continue to try to focus on and get better and better at, because I think there's a push-pull when you love what you do and you love cutting and you just want to do it all the time. And you have to think about the fact that we're a big community, and the best thing we can do is open up doors for other people and give them a shot. So I always encourage my assistants to cut as much as they want. I've worked on a lot of shows that are very demanding on assistants and very hard time schedules. So, you know, I try to have honest conversations with them in terms of how much they want to cut and how we can make time for them to find that space, because it can be really hard and challenging when their day is a full day and they don't have a moment to breathe, but they want to cut and they want to learn. And, you know, I know there's a lot of motivated assistants that will cut in their off time and cut in their off hours, but I think you also should try to give them that space during work time and during the job. How that works out in practice depends on the assistant. It depends on where they're at and what they want from me. That's one of the things I always ask when I interview assistants, is what they're looking to get from working with me and what they want out of editors that they work with. I'll have assistants where I will ask them to cut scenes and they'll share it with me and we'll talk about it and we'll talk about why they made the choices, and I'll give them notes like a director or producer would and give them a chance at addressing notes. And then if I have an assistant who's more nervous about cutting or greener or learning, I will tell them, just pick whatever scene speaks to you, whatever you like, and cut it. And before you watch what I do, cut your own version. And then if you're really excited, like, I'd love to look at it, we can talk about the choices we each made and why we each made them. I've worked with editors that are a little further on and they're ready to move up, and their philosophy has been like, I already know how to cut, I don't need to cut for you. And it's like, okay, great. You let me know what you're looking to get out of this relationship, and I will happily provide it. I think it's something you don't do by accident. So it's something I try to be mindful of. And I think that there's always room for improvement and always more you can do to give back.
Is that also how you moved up, that you had editors that you would have those discussions and say, I do want to cut, or can I cut?
Definitely. You know, I always remember a piece of advice that I overheard one time where someone just kind of offhand made the comment that you should always articulate what you want, and you should articulate it to people that can help you get there. And I try to remember that. Pretty much every editor I worked for was open to letting me cut for them. And it was very much the same thing. I would cut scenes. When we got to a level of trust and we've been working together a long time, they would just assign me scenes to cut and I would cut them and then they would give me notes on them and then that would end up in the show. And it's this huge moment when you're learning to cut, where you're like, I did that. And then you get to follow the process through where you see where the network notes come in, where the director notes are. Even if it's not your hand making the changes, you're really thinking about, I laid the foundation for this. This is how people responded to it. As I got more and more practice, the scenes I was given to cut got more complicated, got bigger. Then you become this integral part of the partnership. And so you become this resource. And I ended up working on shows that had really tight air dates, really hectic schedules. And because I had this working relationship with the editors I worked for, and because I was cutting so much, it was a natural thing for them to say, well, let's bump Kelly up. We already know what her editing style is like. We already know she can do this. She can get a co-editing credit on this. She can take over this episode. And I also was lucky. I worked with some post-producers that also really encouraged growth and were really supportive. And then it was the same thing. My first editing credit was on the show Psych. That whole team was so supportive. The showrunners were really behind me. The post-producer, the editor, it's a really scary thing when you're an assistant and you're getting your first episode to cut. And it felt nice knowing that you weren't in a situation where they were looking for you to fail. You were in a situation where they wanted you to succeed. They wanted to set you up for success and they were encouraging you. And because I came from that, because that's how I got to be where I am, I feel a lot of responsibility to try to do that for other people as well.
You mentioned getting notes, like director notes. Did it ever happen with you, maybe as you got more experience and built more trust, that an editor would let you actually get the notes from the director? Like, you cut a scene, and not only did you get to cut the scene, but the director made notes on your scene and then you got to recut based on the director's notes.
Yes, which is a great experience and was a little scary at first because it's a whole new skill set when you realize someone's right behind you and you got to move quickly. And then as an assistant, I would also be in the room when we were working with directors or producers and taking notes. And my editors would always be very gracious. We're like, well, Kelly cut the scene. Like, Kelly, what did you think? Or, oh, we're looking for this take. Can you think of a solution for this? Which I thought was a really generous way to bring me into the conversation, and getting a chance to practice cutting notes on scenes that I did was a huge benefit. And it's such a different thing than just figuring out how to cut a scene in the first place.
The process part of it's super important. It's just a question of whether anybody allows you to do it.
Yes. And knowing the dynamics in a room, knowing how to interact with people. You know, I like my editing room to be a positive, safe space. I like to think of it as a place to explore, you know, and so something I'm always very conscious of is not to say no too quickly, not to be negative. You have to remember that you might have been living with this scene for weeks or months or however long, but that person that's walking through the door, it's their first crack at it and they are excited to explore it. And you don't want to be the Debbie Downer that's shooting them down or saying, no, that's not going to work. Trust me, I already looked at it. I really believe in being positive, being open, you know, not being defensive, not having a bit of ego. And I think I absorbed a lot of that in the rooms that I was in when I was assisting and watching that those dynamics take place and watching the politics play out.
Offering that to your assistant, the trick would be knowing the director.
Yes.
Is the director willing to do this with an assistant editor, or is he going to feel, he or she going to feel like he's been pawned off?
Absolutely. You don't want to put your assistant in a position where it's going to backfire and go poorly for them. You want it to be a safe space. You want it to be a director that is open and encouraging and excited about that. You know, and that's also something that I would always say to my assistants. If they did cut a scene for me, I'd be like, let's wait and make sure that they like it before we say you cut it. There's no, you know, the last thing you want to be is to say, oh, so-and-so cut the scene. And then you realize that the director is about to have a meltdown over something that maybe has nothing to do with the scene. But you wait until they compliment it. And then you're like, oh, so-and-so did this.
I talked to another editor and they said, my assistant, you know, cut a scene. And then they said, are you going to tell the director that I cut the scene? And he goes, I'm going to tell the director that you cut the scene if they like it.
Yes, exactly.
Otherwise, I'll take the heat and we'll start over again. Exactly. Very important. You mentioned some restructuring that took place, maybe even between episodes. Can you talk about maybe an example that you can think of, but why were things being juggled outside of the way they were constructed in the script?
Part of it was timing and pacing, which you just don't know until you have the performances. The scripts read great from the beginning, and then Joaquin would be able to speak to this better than me because it involves episode one, but there was a lot of time spent on how much of Griselda's backstory do we need to see and live in and experience, and how much did we already know what we needed to know to get on with the story and move forward. And so there were a lot of scenes where we spent time in flashbacks that were changed or evolved or moved, or some were cut. In episode four, there's some intercutting that happens between Griselda giving orders for certain things to be carried out with other scenes, and that, you know, like most things, when you read a script and it says such and such is intercut, you know that's going to find its rhythm once you have everything to work with. But there were some other scenes in episode four that were moved around. When you read the script, it made perfect sense. And then you start seeing things play out and you start thinking about what information and clarity and how certain scenes play off each other. And we ended up reordering a lot of scenes in four. And now it's hard for me to work backwards and remember how they even were to begin with, which I think is just a testament to how well it ultimately worked. Something I really loved about working with Andy is every note he got, no matter where it came from or who it came from, he really took to heart, even if it was a note that might spark a knee-jerk defensive reaction, or you might think, I don't get this note, or they don't get what I'm trying to do. He was always, you know, people say the note behind the note. But he really took every opportunity to look at things, and nothing was precious, and how can we tell the best story? And one of the ways we achieved that with episode four was just moving certain themes around so that a Griselda victory might be juxtaposed against another character, June, the police officer who's tracking her down. You know, where is she at in that emotional state? And, you know, they're not in the same space or the same room together, but there's a rivalry brewing. So, you know, do we want their victories to mirror each other, or do we want Griselda to be at a peak when she's at her lowest point? You know, how are we setting up this conflict and this contrast? And some of it had to do with tracking June, putting the pieces together versus the actions that Griselda was taking at that time. So do we feel like she's hot on her tail, or do we feel like Griselda's way ahead of her, you know? And so it's just really interesting. You feel like even though you're pitching ideas and you're trying things, you also feel like you're discovering so much while you do it. So that order was very fluid. And I'm talking kind of vaguely because it's so hard to kind of unravel how it was before, but there was a lot of time really spent on, you know, the way the different A and B storylines were relating to one another.
That is one of the most fascinating things to me about scripted television, that you can have a great script that you read and you love the script and it seems like to make perfect sense. And then it gets into editing and you're like, the pacing needs to change. The structure needs to change. How does that? It's just amazing.
It's crazy.
I understand why, but
yeah, you know, you read a scene that reads really fast, and then suddenly it's a 5-minute scene, and you're like, "Well, this is killing the momentum here." But if I put it over here, we're engrossed in it, and we have the time to spend 5 minutes with these people. But
or you can intercut it.
Or you can intercut it. One of my favorite things about the process is the eureka moments of like, oh my God, what if we cut this huge chunk? We find brilliance. So I love when you're working with a team that's not too precious. You need a great script, I think, to hit the ground running and to get everyone into the world. And then I think you need to be a little unprecious with it on the back end. And you need to think about, what did that script birth? What material did it give you? And how can you continue to do it justice by putting it together in just the right way?
Kelly, thank you so much for a wonderful discussion. This is a real pleasure talking to you about this show and your approach to the material.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really great to meet you. I'm really happy to be able to participate in this.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors, for a topic-driven curated look at the craft of editing. Thanks to Kelly Stuyvesant for discussing her work on Netflix's Griselda. Thanks also to our partner, Boris Effects,
Be sure to check them out at borisfx.com. I'm Steve Hallfish, ACE. Thanks for listening. And please tell all the editors and filmmakers that you know that to get more great Art of the Cut interviews every week, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app. And if you want a good follow on socials, I'm on Twitter and Instagram as @SteveHallfish.